The Concussion Crisis, subtitled Anatomy of a Silent Epidemic, begins with the story of a young man with whom, quote, concussions caught up before he could play a single down of college football. Dave Showalter, the subject of that story, shook off concussions as a child and throughout his high school football career, but they eventually derailed his life. Linda Carroll and David Rossner are the co-authors of The Concussion Crisis, and Linda Carroll joins me now from Philadelphia. Welcome to Only a Game.
Hi.
Linda, tell us more about Dave Showalter and why you chose to begin your book with his story.
Dave Showalter, you know, played football from the time he was like a little kid. I mean, he and his brothers used to play knee football on the floor of their mother's, you know, their parents' house. And he got into tackle football pretty early in life, and it was really important to him. And even though he was suffering concussions and sometimes experiencing fairly significant symptoms, he kept playing. When he got to college, you know, he kept having concussions, and ultimately he had such bad symptoms that he couldn't do his classwork. He would look at his notebooks and start reading the notes that he'd taken in class, and he wouldn't even remember that he'd been in the class. So he went to a neuropsychologist who told him that the number of concussions he had was pretty much unknown, but it was clear that they'd had some pretty serious effect on his brain and that he might never completely recover from them. And she told him never to play football again. You know, he took time off and he started feeling better. He had no symptoms and he went back to play. And then his academic career went totally down the drain because, you know, he failed classes and he couldn't keep up and he dropped out of school. And when, you know, by the time we met him, he was living in a tiny apartment and supporting himself by delivering bagels. I mean, and he's a really smart guy. You know, his story best showed what can happen to someone when concussions aren't taken seriously.
In the chapter titled Through the Cracks, you write about the work of a psychologist named Wayne Gordon, who believes that traumatic brain injuries can lead to learning disabilities. What is the evidence for that connection?
A lot of the kids who have problems learning tended to have brain traumas somewhere in their history. Wayne Gordon actually went into the schools in New York City and studied kids and interviewed them and their parents to find out what their history was. And kids with learning disabilities often had some kind of brain trauma, whether it was a concussion or a more severe injury.
You conclude at one point that the publicity surrounding NFL players who've been sidelined with concussions will make younger athletes and the parents of those athletes more aware of head injuries and the consequences. But isn't there a danger that youngsters will argue, hey, Ben Roethlisberger keeps coming back after multiple concussions, why shouldn't I?
I think the hope is that the example is maybe you can come back after concussions, but only if you have them diagnosed and managed properly. I mean, the example of Ben Roethlisberger is that, yes, he has concussions and, yes, he comes back, but he goes to the concussion clinic, he gets tested after each concussion, and he doesn't get to go back to play until his symptoms have resolved. I mean, one thing we do know today is that if you have a concussion and you don't manage it, if you just keep playing, the results are so much more dire than if you took time off and let your brain recover before you went back and possibly sustained another concussion.
A lot of the discussion of concussions and the problems they've caused athletes later in life has focused on men playing football or hockey, but you found that girls and women are especially vulnerable to concussions, in part because they assume they won't get them. Why would they assume that?
It's not just the girls, you know, it's the parents and the coaches. And, you know, everybody just assumes that girls don't play as hard as boys do. And so the assumption, you know, what follows from that is that, you know, girls aren't going to be hitting hard enough to get concussions. You know, whereas there are plenty of girls out there who play every bit as hard as the boys do.
I guess I'm not surprised at the general assumption that girls don't play as hard as boys do, but I'm very surprised that that assumption is apparent in the girls themselves, the female athletes.
you know, we grow up thinking we're just not as aggressive as the boys. And, you know, we feel like, you know, second-class athletic citizens. I think sometimes girls even play harder because they feel like, you know, everyone views them as not playing as hard as boys.
Dr. Douglas Smith argued in the Journal of Neuroscience 2 years ago that, as you write, quote, concussions could cause permanent changes in neurons in the brain. Permanent changes, especially second concussions, when the brain hasn't fully recovered from the first one. Do you think that that belief has been accepted in the athletic community and beyond?
I think it will perhaps someday be accepted, but people don't want to believe it because they don't want to change the way they play their games. They like the games the way they are, and it's preferable, if you like the games the way they are, to dismiss the science.
We've spoken about concussions suffered by athletes, but lots of men serving in Iraq and Afghanistan have also been victims of traumatic brain injury. What have the doctors and scientists learned from working with soldiers who've come back from service there?
You know, even though there's a lot of brain injury going on in Iraq and Afghanistan, where you really saw people studying concussions was on the playing field, because there were so many concussions happening all along. And now what's happened is that the military has kind of turned to the model that's been developed in the sports arena to diagnose and manage concussions and brain injuries. Maybe not, you know, the severe brain injuries are something that I think the military had more experience dealing with, but everything in between severe and so-called mild brain injuries, you were seeing more in the sports arena.
The subtitle of your book is Anatomy of a Silent Epidemic. What leads you to characterize the epidemic of concussions and brain injuries as still silent in 2011? Because it seems to me that it's gotten a fair amount of publicity.
People still dismiss, you know, what happens to them personally. You know, I mean, you watch the football players and the hockey players, and you see them have these dramatic concussions, and you see them missing games. But that doesn't necessarily mean you've taken that to apply to yourself. You know, you have a car accident and, you know, you get rattled, but you can walk away from the car accident. You figure you're okay. There's probably a lot of people out there who are suffering from the after effects of some kind of brain injury, you know, whether it's a concussion or something more severe, who don't know that the changes in their lives were caused by that brain injury. You know, the symptoms can be fairly subtle, but life-changing. You know, your memory isn't the same. You know, your concentration's not what it used to be. You can't organize stuff. But those things can be subtle enough that you don't really attribute it. I mean, that's one of the reasons it's kind of a silent epidemic, is because people don't always attribute what's happened to them to the injury they had to their brain.
With David Rossner, Linda Carroll wrote The Concussion Crisis, Anatomy of a Silent Epidemic. The book is published by Simon & Schuster, and Linda Carroll joined me from Philadelphia. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Well, thank you.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world. extension.harvard.edu. And Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
Among the most successful surfers at a competition held in Huntington Beach, California last weekend was Abby Huey, whose ride covered 60 meters or 197 feet. That may not sound like much of a ride, but Abby is an Australian Kelpie dog, and no dog had ever stayed that long on a moving surfboard, at least according to the people at Guinness World Records. Abby set the record during the Surf City Surf Dog competition at a venue called Dog Beach, where canines are free to run, dig, and, of course, surf without cumbersome leashes, although they do wear life jackets. I'm sure you're relieved to hear that.